rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Good morning, thank you. Be seated, please. We welcome you to this session of the Idaho Supreme Court meeting Friday, August 25th, 2023. We appreciate the courtesies and the work county has gone to allow us to be here and to accommodate us for these three hearings we have today. First, that matter before us. It's entitled AC and CE Investments Incorporated versus Eagle Creek Irrigation Company. The appellant here is AC and CE Investments, represented by And Edward Lawson represents respondent Eagle Creek Irrigation Company. Good morning, counsel. Each of you, either of you have any preliminary matters for the court before we begin today?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Becker, then you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Cale Becker. I'm the attorney for appellant AC and CE Investments, Inc. This is a novel case regarding the rights of Idaho's landowners to continue irrigating their property as they and their predecessors have done for decades without fear that a slim majority of insiders can engage in corporate mischief designed to disenfranchise the minority of their highly valuable right to irrigate their land. Idaho's Constitution contains 21 individual articles. The legislative branch has an article. The right to engage in democracy through elections has an article. The judiciary has an article. And water rights have an entire article devoted to their protection. Idaho's founding fathers were wise and knew that the protection of the time, labor, and energy expended to make productive lands out of the arid west was sacred ground worthy of protection in our Constitution. It is through this lens that we must view the matters at issue in this case. While this case concerns land near Sun Valley, ECI's position, if adopted by this court, sets the stage for the well-heeled to gobble up water from Idaho's hard-working family farmers by corporate sleight of hand. Idaho's founding fathers anticipated these types of issues based on games played by commercial ditch companies, which were prevalent at the time of Idaho's statehood. It is for this reason Article 15, Section 4 was enacted. That article guarantees irrigators the right to continued annual use of their water as long as they comply with equitable terms and conditions as to the quantity used and times of use as may be prescribed by law. However, until now, this court has not had the opportunity to carefully examine where corporate law ends and Idaho's constitutional and trust law steps in to protect irrigators from antics more often seen on Wall Street. In Idaho, it is a well-settled rule of public policy that the right to the use of public water from the state can only be claimed where it is applied to a beneficial use in the matter required by law. And that's the U.S. v. Pioneer irrigation case, this court's decision. Here, that beneficial use of the waters of Eagle Creek are domestic and irrigation purposes as specified in ECIC's water right. That beneficial use is primarily the application of water to land, which is owned by individuals and entities owning land within ECIC's service area, such as my client. Importantly, ECIC owns no land. This application of water to land is the continuing purpose of the trust ECIC functioned as. This court's prior holding in Eagle Creek Irrigation Company versus AC and CE Investments declared the water right held by ECIC is pertinent to the entire ECIC service area, not any individual property owner's land. However, in that same decision, this court declared that ECIC held those water rights in trust for the landowners within ECIC's service area, which includes AC&CE's property.
That finding of being held in trust was based upon the language of the bylaws and the articles, correct?
That was the basis of the decision. I don't think the issue before the court fully focused on the full scope of the trust nature.
So you're saying anything we said in the earlier decision about trust and such is dicta then?
Well, this court, the lower court here, then held that trust did exist and was recognized by this court. So as I read the record on this case, we have a trust that was established. The ultimate basis for the district court's decision was looking at the change structure of BCIC. And so I think there's a bit of a nuance here that there really wasn't a discussion of whether the trust could be eliminated under the terms of the trust law.
Right. I just wanted to be clear that the trust that we commented on in our earlier decision wasn't some kind of constructive trust or some kind of constitutionally created trust. It was a trust that was created by the organizational doctors, documents that were in effect at that time.
The settlers of the trust created the trust, and our position is once that trust was created, its termination was governed by trust law.
Right, it would be controlled by the trust indenture, wouldn't it?
Well, the trust indenture as viewed through the lens of Idaho's constitutional provisions and Idaho's trust law provisions. And so that obviously brings into view the fiduciary duties incumbent in the trustee, the continuation of a material purpose of the trust, which in our view is the continued application of water to the lands within ECIC service area. So I don't think that the trust can simply be eliminated by a majority vote here because there's an ongoing continuing purpose for which the original settlers envisioned when they created this trust instrument.
The council, the articles of the corporation created the trust, correct?
That was the decision of the settlers when they created the trust was to create this corporate entity that functioned as a trust.
And the articles in the incorporation or the bylaws outline how that corporation and trust is regulated, right?
Subject to Idaho constitutional and trust laws. And that was specific in the original governing documents that they can only be amended in compliance with Idaho constitutional provisions and other laws.
What provision excludes then the articles from creating a basis to amend or terminate the trust?
Well, as this court's aware, the common law of England supplements Idaho law. I don't have the section here before me, but there's an Idaho Code section that specifically allows the English common law to supplement statutory provisions. Here, we look to the restatements for what the common law is. The trust cannot be eliminated without the consent of all of the beneficiaries. And even if all the beneficiaries consent, we can't have an elimination of a trust where there's some continuing ongoing purpose. And our position is that the settlers envision that continuing ongoing purpose of allowing the water to continue to be applied to the lands within ECIC service area. And so without the consent of all the beneficiaries, and frankly, without the consent of contingent beneficiaries, future beneficiaries, I don't see how ECIC could eliminate that trust relationship.
So you're essentially suggesting this is an irrevocable trust, then?
That's what I'm suggesting here. That was the relationship that was created, and that was the relationship that shareholders throughout the ages were content with and complied with until such time as ECIC saw fit during the middle of litigation to attempt to eliminate a trust relationship.
Can we get to that conclusion from the four corners of the trust document, or do we have to look outside the document to conclude that it's irrevocable?
Well, the four corners of the trust document state that it can only be amended in compliance with Idaho constitutional law and other laws. So I think that's an expansive definition within the four corners of the trust. So, yes, that then does bring in
the common law and Idaho constitutional law within the corporate.
Is it the revocation that would be unconstitutional, or what replaced the trust that we would have to look at to determine whether it was unconstitutional?
I think in practice, the actions of ECIC are unconstitutional, because what we've set the stage for here is that a 51% majority interest can work to deprive the minority of their water right by continuing to dilute that that beneficial interest over and over again by corporate fiat. If ECIC was not sued here, there's little doubt that additional shares would have been handed out here. Once the trust relationship was eliminated, my client, its water right could have been diluted to the point that it was almost meaningless, and that beneficial interest could be applied to 51% of the land.
You've used the phrase 51%, slim majority. What was the actual majority in this case?
Well, the actual vote, I believe, was 75%. However, having been to numerous ECIC board meetings, essentially the group of insiders is there running the show, and most of the landowners within ECIC service area are out-of-state residents.
Well, notwithstanding your suspicions, though, calling this a slim majority is factually inaccurate, isn't it?
The holding, ECIC's position applies whether or not it's a 75% majority or a 51%
majority. Right, so you came to us talking about sacred land, using some incendiary language, and saying that these terrible things were done by a slim majority, when in fact they were done by a 75% majority. That would be more than a supermajority, correct?
It would be, yes, Your Honor. Again, the trust, the common law of trust, I still believe whether it was 99% majority would still apply here, that without the consent of all the beneficiaries and with the continuing ongoing purpose of the trust, that it was not possible to eliminate this trust relationship.
Well, you said even more than that, though. You said that even if they all agreed, they couldn't do it.
That's correct, because there's contingent beneficiaries, the future owners of land within the ECIC service area.
So help me understand what constitutional provision you believe this action violated.
Idaho Constitution Article 15, Section 4 is the primary constitutional provision.
And why?
Well, by doubling the number of shares, that will set the stage for a dilution of my client's proportionate interest. The same amount of water has been applied for decades to my client's land. Whenever the number of shares is doubled and they start being handed out on a preferential basis, it's a foregone conclusion that there will be winners and losers in that type of preferential treatment.
Is it a foregone conclusion, or do we need to wait to see that actually happen?
It's already happened, Your Honor. I have a share right here that is in the record. This is Felicia Tesfunky. She has the new shares that represent 414 shares now being issued that still contain the 1 miner's inch measurement. So we have this occurring, and I think my client's litigation has put a stop to that, because I think ECIC wants to wait and see what this court will do with this.
Regardless of how we count the shares, is the pro rata share of the overall water right available, has that been reduced?
Well, ECIC doesn't monitor anything, and so has my client not been able to apply water to his land once he became a shareholder? No, there's been no actual reduction in terms of my client's land going fallow. However, I think that's a real risk here, and this is a highly valuable water right in Sun Valley. And so I think my client has every right to be concerned whenever the shares are being handed out on a buddy-buddy system. It seems that this can lead to my client's land potentially being fallow or dried up to the point that it's unusable.
Counsel, aren't you arguing, though, that your client's rights are actually being reduced as a result of the Stevens mitigation agreement?
I think, again, in practice, my client's rights, there's been no present reduction in my client's ability to irrigate, and that has to do with the amount of rainfall we received during the pendency of this litigation, and frankly, the lack of monitoring by ECIC. And so the Stevens mitigation agreement...
Mr. Becker, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we seem to have lost our timer. Is the 629 accurate?
Yes, I stopped the timer when I went up to the next page.
All right, so there's 6 minutes 29 left of your opening time, sir. I'm sorry for the disjunction here. I also failed to mention that Judge Simpson is with us and Justice Brody has recused herself. That's my mistake. I apologize. I know that all was stopped, and now we can move on. Thank you.
Yes.
If I can ask you, I'm going to change the issue I want to talk about a little bit. I want to give you an opportunity to respond to the allegation that this is a derivative action and you failed to plead a derivative action. And I'm wondering, do you agree this is a derivative action?
I do not agree this is a derivative action. We view this as a beneficiary seeking redress from a trustee. And the corporate structure of this ECIC is certainly an interesting animal here, but at best it's a direct action with a shareholder that has a unique interest here. And my client has the guaranteed right of 7% of ECIC's water being applied to its land by virtue of the end right agreement. And again, frankly, under Idaho constitutional law, I think there's a recognition that, frankly, this type of trust relationship and where ECIC serves as a fiduciary, that people's constitutional rights can't be taken away through corporate fiat. And that's really what is at the heart of this case here is, again, we're talking about a small mutual irrigation benefit company. If we look at this holistically, a 51% interest under general corporate law principles could amend its bylaws and slowly migrate shares or issue preferential shares or take whatever corporate actions are deemed appropriate under general corporate law principles.
How is this different than any other canal company in the state of Idaho that issues shares based upon land ownership within a specified area?
Well, as this court recognized in ECIC versus ACNCE, there's a number of different types of entities, Carry Act, mutual benefit, ditch companies. And so there are different types of entities.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the different types, though. There's a lot of canal companies that are very similar to the ones, at least I'm familiar with a lot, that are very similar to this one. And I'm just wondering, what makes the shares in this company different than the shares that people across the state own in similar kind of companies?
Well, again, the irrigation district statutory provisions explicitly create a trust relationship. And so our view is in this particular situation, this mutual benefit irrigation company attempted to mimic that trust relationship that was statutorily recognized.
So, Mr. Becker, I want to bring us back to Justice Zahn's question about the derivative nature of the action. So if your clients own 7%, how is their 7% different than the other 93%?
They have a contractual right to that 7%.
So you're referring to the Enright agreement?
Correct.
So the Enright agreement's pretty interesting to me and has caused me some concern. But first of all, how does the Enright agreement survive? Second of all, I know that there is a settlement agreement that was entered into, and I think it's at 205 of the record. But when you go to that settlement agreement, it's not signed by any party. It indicates that AC and CE recognizes they're bound by the Enright agreement. I don't see any agreement as to the irrigation company. And I don't see any description of the land that's attached to the Enright agreement either. There's some rudimentary drawings attached to it.
That issue hasn't been challenged on appeal, but I don't think it's disputed that ECIC was a signatory to the Enright agreement.
I'm not talking about the Enright agreement signatories. I'm talking about the settlement agreement. I don't see any signatures on that agreement.
The particular copy you may be referring to in the record, I'm not.
Is there another place?
Sure. I don't think there's any dispute that all parties signed that, and that's what gave basis to the original appeal in ECIC versus AC&C.
And the other thing that you argued real quick today, but you've mentioned in your brief, that you're in a unique status because of the Enright agreement. You indicate that you're guaranteed 7%, but that Enright agreement talks about a pro rata share still.
Correct.
So how is that unique from somebody who owns 10 shares within this district?
Because it's a proportional definition that is unique to my client. I'm not aware of any other agreements that define a proportional allocation tied to a specific share number. And where we've got a doubling in number of shares from 207 to 414, that 7% automatically has become watered down. My client still has 15 shares, and yet other people have additional shares that on their face allow them to continue to divert one miner's inch per share. So it's a watering down of my client's 7% interest. Again, in practice, it has not happened yet, but I attribute that to lack of monitoring and rainfall conditions during the course of the litigation.
So I want to circle back to the derivative claim, because you said it's derivative, this is a beneficiary pursuing an action against a trustee, and yet throughout your brief, you use the term ultra vires, which is a derivative claim term. And then you mentioned fiduciary duties, but corporations also, different actors in corporations owe fiduciary duties to shareholders and to others. So I'm struggling to understand why this isn't a derivative action. It's a shareholder asserting claims against the corporation, saying the corporation exceeded its powers. That's a derivative action, isn't it?
I understand the course of your position on that. And again, ECIC is an interesting animal of a corporation within a trust, and so I think we have to look at both sets of laws here.
Isn't it a trust within a corporation?
Yes. Yes. And what's interesting about that is it's a nonprofit corporation. And so it is not a business trust. And there's a whole subset of law in business trust. However, business trusts are to be conducted for profit. And ECIC is explicitly a non-profit, and I would argue that it was a trust relationship that was set up. And so the derivative nature of the claim, again, I think that we have to look at this whole holistically. If we're going to simply rely on Rule 78 and the leading forms for derivative actions, then we get back to generally, a 51% interest in a corporation can set the stage to rob the 49% minority interest owners of their valuable water rights.
But the settlers agreed to that when they created this animal, didn't they? I mean, the settlers, they put in their shares, they create bylaws, they created this. They agreed to it when they created it, didn't they?
With the inclusion of the term trust at a time when there was irrigation districts that had a trust relationship also enshrined. And so I think that that was what was trying to be mimicked here. And then, again, the bylaws said they can only be amended within, in compliance with Idaho statutory and constitutional law. And so I understand I may be making a public policy argument, we may be making new law here today. You're right, I cannot point to a specific law that says thou shalt not perform these types of corporate sleights of hand. However, when we look at the trust law and the cases addressing exactly what does a beneficial owner of a water right have, and it's a beneficial interest, it's an equitable interest in the continued application of water to their land that is a state piece of property allocated pursuant to state law to an irrigation district simply to distribute that water to the beneficial owners. And that's where we come back to the protections enshrined in Idaho's Constitution. And so those protections are enshrined for the individual applicators. And that's in Bradshaw versus Milner Lowlift Irrigation District. That there's a recognition that, yes, the district is the applicator. However, the ultimate parties entitled to the constitutional protections are the applicators of the water to their lands. And that's where my client stands. And I see that I've gone over my time at this point.
Thank you. Lawson, when you're ready, sir.
If it please the court, the facts of this matter excuse me, are largely undisputed. The applicable law, I submit, is very clear. AC and CE purported to bring direct claims, declaratory relief relating to an amendment of the articles and bylaws, and breach of fiduciary duty, all of which claims, I submit, are derivative claims. AC and CE failed to satisfy the requirements of the Idaho Code and the rules of civil procedure applicable to the pursuit of derivative claims. Whether derivative or direct claims, claims wholly lack any merit whatsoever. ECIC, my client, prevailed at the district court level on all the claims brought by ACCE and should be awarded attorney's fees, including attorney's fees on appeal. The district court correctly identified the difference between derivative and direct claims. Derivative claims being those involving injury to the corporation or to the whole body of shareholders or the property, in this case, the water rights. It relied on the McCann versus McCann case. Conversely, direct claims require a specific injury to the shareholder distinct from any other shareholder, and that's where ACCE's case fails. The district court ruled that ACCE was not entitled to bring derivative claims because it didn't fulfill the requirements of state law, and that it ultimately determined that it failed to establish any distinct injury, an injury distinct from the injury, if any, to other shareholders. As Justice Zahn pointed out, all of the claims are essentially ultra vires claims, which are claims that the board acted in excess of its lawful authority. Specifically, the claim is that the board had no power to cause the amendment of the Articles of Incorporation to delete the language regarding there being a trust, or to authorize additional shares, or to permit the mitigation agreement that was entered into between Mr. and Mrs. Stevens, one of the shareholders, and the Idaho Department of Water Resources. These are all Travera's claims involving an injury to the corporation alleged and to its water rights, which would impact all shareholders the same way. Conversely, they are claims that do not involve a specific injury to AC and CE, distinct from other shareholders. They are therefore derivative claims.
Before we go further down that path, could you address for me the question you raised in your brief about justiciability, both standing and rightness? I've heard from the appellants that nothing's happened to their water yet, so how are these claims right in your view? And then the standing question hasn't been discussed either. Now, to me, those are issues we have to get to first.
Okay.
So could you address those for me, sir?
Yeah, I mean, you heard the argument. You've read the briefs. The whole thing is predicated upon some sort of fear of abuse, the various conduct by ECIC's board of volunteers. That hasn't happened. That hasn't happened. And there's no factual basis for the concern that it will.
Can you address Mr. Becker's contention that increased shares have already been issued?
Well, they haven't been. Felicitas Funk was issued a new certificate when she got a divorce. She applied for and got a new certificate. But the number of shares hasn't changed. The only thing that's different on the new certificate that was issued in response to her surrender of the original certificate is that it recites that the number of authorized shares has been increased from 207 to 414.
Why hasn't the ownership of the shareholders been diluted by that increase in the number of shares?
The authorization to increase shares does not result in a dilution. It would be the actual issuance of additional authorized shares that would cause a dilution. That hasn't happened.
Why would you authorize an increased number of shares unless you intended to issue them?
The discussion at the board level was that there were additional shares authorized that had not been issued, but there was, I think, less than 20 shares were available to be issued. And the board felt that they needed to be prepared in case there was a need to make a significant capital improvement to issue additional shares. So far, that hasn't happened. So planning for the future.
What about the Stevens mitigation unit agreement? Because in that agreement, it requires that the water be diverted past the last, or stay in the creek until the last diversion. Where's the last diversion? And if that water actually goes into the Wood River, doesn't that impact AC and CE?
Does not. AC and CE is the first property to divert water out of the creek. It's the most upstream property in the system.
But the diversion upstream, though, doesn't it take water into the high ditch first?
No, I think the water comes right out of Eagle Creek to ACE's property before it's diverted into either ditch.
Clear.
So as a consequence, ACE and CE has not lost any water, and that was admitted by council in their presentation. They have not received an inch or any less water as a result of any of these amendments or the mitigation agreement.
So in the mitigation agreement, it required that a certain amount of water go to the high ditch, right?
To keep the ditch wet, yes.
And then the remaining of Stevens' shares would stay in Eagle Creek and go past the last diversion.
Correct.
And when I read Mr. Stevens' deposition, he's all over the place. It seems like he's using groundwater 1 year and then his shares the next year, and then he says, no, I'm always pumping groundwater. And then he makes a comment about the water coming in and actually going onto a pasture and into the Wood River. And so can you explain what was going on there and how that impacts the...
I don't know what Mr. Stevens has been doing, but frankly, I don't think Mr. Stevens knows what he's doing. That said, the deal that he made with Water Resources was that he would not take water out of Eagle Creek. His entitlement to the water out of Eagle Creek, he would forfeit that in return for the right to have groundwater pulled out of his property or on his property from his well.
It was essentially a mitigation agreement.
Exactly. And the key there, I believe, is that Eagle Creek Irrigation Company is not a party to that agreement. It consented to the arrangement at the request of Water Resources, but it's not a party to the arrangement.
But to consent, don't you have to have approval from the board?
Yeah, and the board approved.
Okay. And isn't that what ACE is saying was a breach of the fiduciary duty?
That's what they're saying, but it wasn't, because there's no interference with any shareholders' rights. All they're doing is allowing the water to stay in Eagle Creek. So it's as if a water right holder, a shareholder, chose not to irrigate. It's no different than that. So there's no harm to any of the shareholders as a result of that mitigation agreement. That was the Water Resources intent. That was the board's intent. And I believe it's true. I don't have any independent knowledge of what Mr. Stevens is doing or not doing.
So could that agreement result in there being more water in the creek, in the ditches?
I guess there could be if Mr. Stevens was not at the end of the creek. Essentially, he is. He's at the end of the creek. He was historically unable to get water because the canal had been obstructed by the construction of a home. And so the benefit to the shareholders and to Eagle Creek as an entity was that this solved their obligation to Stevens to provide water. So they felt that it was in the company's best interest to go along with the arrangement. And in fact, it is.
Sir, can I ask you a question about the trust? I'm just curious, when Article 6, Section 4 was removed, what was behind the decision not to use similar trust language in the new replace language?
That decision was a result of having an ACCE claim that there were responsibilities of the board as trustees. And the board and the shareholders felt that that was confusing the ability to govern the entity and wanted to eliminate the confusion and address the issue raised by ACC, which was that they weren't trustees, they were board members.
So in other words, it would be run strictly like a corporation and not have the dual responsibilities of administering a trust and a corporation.
Correct. And the feeling was that the responsibilities didn't change, that the fiduciary obligations of the board were identical to the fiduciary obligations of the trustee. And so as a consequence, there was no harm, if you will, to any of the shareholders, no reduction in the scope of obligation. And we cited in our briefing the basis for that conclusion. I think it's 3036.17 defines the responsibilities of the board. They do have the benefit of the business judgment rule in Idaho, but so did the trustees. So as a consequence, there's no difference in the standard of care expected of the board members with the elimination of that trust manager.
Would you please respond to Mr. Becker's argument that Eagle Creek's decision violate Article 15, Section 4 of the Idaho Constitution?
Well, the Idaho Constitution, if I'm understanding it correctly, simply assures water right holders of the ability to access the water and to distribute the irrigation water on their land. Nothing that was done by ECIC through its board of directors or otherwise impairs that whatsoever. And the important thing about this case, the thing that's made so frustrating about it to my client, is that it's all predicated upon a fear of something that might happen in the future, which is your concern. None of these things have happened. And there's no reason to think they ever will. There's no reason to think that ECIC wants to dilute the percentage interest of shares held by ACC. No facts whatsoever.
So if the shares are issued, would that not dilute ACCE's proportional ownership of the Vice to Water and of the Eagle Creek?
You know, Justice Stigner, it could, depending upon how they were issued. If they were issued with preemptive rights for all existing shareholders to acquire additional shares to prevent the dilution, which would be a very common thing to do, then that wouldn't. If they were sold to an existing shareholder, giving that shareholder majority control over the company, then I'm sure we'd hear about it, and I think I would have a hard time not admitting that that would be a breach of fiduciary obligation. But that's when that issue should be challenged. That's when the act of issuing the shares should be taken before the courts, not the authorization to do it. I want to emphasize there's always been authorized but unissued shares within Eagle Creek Irrigation Company. And those shares have never been offered to anybody for any purpose whatsoever. And there have been requests for that. But the board has declined to issue those shares of stock. So the only facts that exist relative to the concern mitigate against there being a legitimacy to the concern. The district court found that ACCE was not entitled to pursue derivative claims. It was convinced, unfortunately, that there could possibly be some factual basis for the breach of fiduciary obligation claim arising from the combination of the Enright agreement and the mitigation agreement. And it denied our effort to obtain summary judgment on the whole case and gave ACCE opportunity to conduct discovery, to pursue their claims, prove up the legitimacy of their fears of misuse and nefarious conduct. Excuse me. And we sat through a dozen or more depositions. No facts produced. Nothing produced to put any meat on the bone of the skeleton that they've created here about there being reason to be concerned about a future breach of fiduciary obligation. It doesn't exist. Yet we spent tens of thousands of dollars on their fishing expedition to no avail. And if you look at the Enright agreement, it doesn't do anything different than acknowledge what the governing documents provide all shareholders, which is a right to a proportionate amount of the available water from the company. That's what it does. It doesn't change anything, and there's never been any explanation offered to the district court or to this court as to how the existence of that Enright agreement creates the possibility of a separate injury distinct from injury potential to all the shareholders that would give them a direct claim. Just the record is devoid of that entirely. So I'm convinced, and hopefully you'll be persuaded, that these are all derivative claims. There was never a direct claim, and they pursued their discovery and were unable to prove any direct injury whatsoever, and ultimately the district court so held. The consequences of that are this case shouldn't be here at all. Idaho Code 303304 mandates all actions based upon a lack of authority have to be brought in a derivative action before third parties acquire any rights. A direct action based upon ultra vires conduct is prohibited under Idaho law. And Stevens did acquire rights under the mitigation agreement with the Department of Water Resources. So even if the absolute prohibition against direct actions involving ultra-virus conduct was not applicable, because Stevens acquired rights through the permit issued by the Department of Water Resources in reliance upon the mitigation agreement, they can't have brought, meaning AC&CE cannot have brought an ultra-virus action against the company. Idaho Code 3034.11 Part 3 establishes requirements for initiating a derivative claim. Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 78 prescribes the pleading requirements for a derivative claim. None of those requirements were ever satisfied by AC&CE. They ignored them. They stuck to the position they're bringing a direct claim. Now, the fact is, there was never a demand made upon ECIC to rescind the amendments. There was never a demand made to reject the mitigation agreement and the amended complaint filed by AC&CE against my client was never verified, which is required by both Idaho Code 3034.11 and Rule 78.
Judge Williamson held, though, that the initial complaint was and that was sufficient.
He did. And I want to emphasize that ECIC didn't ignore that initial complaint. It, in fact, took it seriously and investigated the claims. It, in fact, went the extra step and formed a litigation committee of disinterested shareholders to conduct that investigation. Those disinterested shareholders hired independent corporate counsel to help with the investigation and to provide legal advice in the course of its work. That litigation committee looked at all the documentation, they looked at all the briefing, they looked at all the agreements, they interviewed all of the shareholders, and they issued a report. And the report went through a number of things, basically holding that the actions were derivative, they were not direct, there was no harm to anybody, that none of the shareholders wanted to pursue the claims, and the claims wholly lacked any merit, and that therefore it was not in the company's best interest to pursue the claims. I submit that, although there's no Idaho case law on point, the purpose of the litigation committee was to pull back those claims as derivative claims that belong to the company, investigate those claims, exercise business judgment, and make a determination of whether the company should pursue the claims or not, all of which took place. But when that litigation committee asserted its authority over the claims, the rights of AC&CE disappeared because the company took those claims and properly investigated them, analyzed them, and reached a conclusion that they were not in the company's best interest to pursue. Most importantly, I think, put away all the technical issues about independent injury or distinct injury, derivative versus direct claims. Claims have no merit under any structure. The amendments to the bylaws and the articles of incorporation were properly made by the shareholders of Eagle Creek Irrigation Company. And there's no legal impediment to their having done that. The amendments are allowed under the Nonprofit Corporation Act 3037.01. The amendments were permissible under the governing documents. This fact that the company is a nonprofit corporation formed by the settlors of the supposed trust is important. The trust was basically formed as a nonprofit corporation under Idaho law intentionally. Well, there's no trust agreement wherein the beneficiaries are identified and the trustees appointed. There's a one word in the original articles that used that said the water was held in trust for the benefits of the land. And from that, with due respect, this court held that there was a trust formed. It wasn't an irrevocable trust. It was a trust that was selected to be formed as an Idaho nonprofit corporation.
There was no trust ever registered.
No trust was ever registered. The organizers of the corporation chose to be a nonprofit corporation. In doing that, they submitted to the laws of the state relating to nonprofit corporations. And they created articles of incorporation, bylaws, and conducted business in accordance with those code provisions under Idaho law and in accordance with their governing documents. Critically, the governing documents expressly permitted them to be amended.
Mr. Lawson, before you run out of time, could you address your cross-appeal regarding the attorney's fees below and on appeal?
Yes, I would be glad to do that. We believe that Rule 54 in Idaho Code Section 12120 and 12121 entitle Eagle Creek Irrigation Company to award of fees in this case. We argue that to the district judge. District judge, because ACCE prevailed on the declaratory relief claim that there was a trust created as a result of the decision by this court in Eagle Creek Irrigation 1, that both parties prevailed in part, and therefore my client was not entitled to attorney's fees. I would submit, however, that was an error. It was basically a gimme by this court to ACCE. By this court ruling that a trust was created, it basically compelled the district judge to reach the same conclusion as a result of that use of the word trust in that one section of the original articles. ACCE never really had to pursue proof of its claim. We have abandoned the argument that trust word didn't actually create a trust and relied upon the ability to amend the trust, which ultimately was a successful argument. The point here being that if you look at the claims on an overall basis and not a claim-by-claim basis, which is what I understand the rule requires, Eagle Creek Irrigation Company was clearly the prevailing party.
So you're talking about the 18-mile analysis?
Yes, sir.
Have you abandoned, there was some reference to attorney's fees under 12117. Today I've just heard you mention 12120 and 12121. Is that the sole basis that you're seeking them on now?
Well, yeah, I think that they are the most applicable. We do believe there's a meritorious argument to be made that this was a commercial transaction. This was not a consumer transaction. It was not a personal, family, or household purpose underlying the reasons for the acquisition of the property or the government's decisions by Eagle Creek Irrigation Company, and therefore it would be appropriate for the court to have awarded fees under 12120 Part 3.
I'm struggling with that. I tend to think it's neither a commercial transaction nor one for personal or household purposes. I mean, we've got the breach of fiduciary duty, which is in the nature of tort. And then we've got the declaratory judgment, which is looking at, you know, essentially the bylaws and saying, you know, was this done correctly or not? I'm not seeing a commercial transaction in either one of those. So help me understand, what am I missing?
Well, I think the point I would make is that there was a contract here, meaning the governing documents amount to a contract between the corporation and the shareholders. And that the allegations are essentially that the power under that contract was exceeded. And by making that claim, the contractual provisions of Idaho 12120 Part 3 come into play. I think it maybe is incorrect, but I've always thought that it was an either-or situation. You either had a commercial transaction or you didn't. And if it was a personal, family, or household purpose, it was a consumer transaction, in effect, and not a commercial transaction.
Well, I agree with you. You either have a commercial transaction or you don't, but I don't know that the only other thing you can have is a personal or household transaction, is what I'm saying. I think it's somewhere else, but thank you for the explanation.
That's my view.
Is there any different basis, assuming we weren't inclined to find that the trial judge abused his discretion on the attorney's fee decision below, is there any reason why we should look at it on appeal differently?
Yeah, I think that you have the right to award fees on appeal.
Well, I know we can, but why should we?
Why should you? Because the case was essentially pursued from the start unreasonably and without foundation.
But see, that sounds like we're looking back to the course of the proceedings below. Has there been anything unique about the course of proceedings on appeal that would cause us to reach a different conclusion than the judge did below?
Yeah, I think the collective wisdom of this court would lead to the conclusion that the appeal was pursued frivolously without reason or foundation, which is the standard in 12-121. And I think that that's evident from the fact that the claims were never right. The claims were always derivative claims. They were never direct claims. There's never been any proof offered of how they could possibly be direct claims. I mean, imagine this. How do you amend articles and bylaws and create an individual claim? It's almost by definition impossible. They say that, well, it's because of the Enright Agreement. But the Enright Agreement doesn't really do anything. They didn't plead breach of contract. They, in fact, abandoned their claim for damages, all of which, in my mind, suggests that they knew there was no direct harm. They knew it. And they, when they, in the Eagle Creek 1, they sought to amend their complaint to add these very same claims and characterize them as derivative claims in that case. Judge Brody declined permission to amend the complaint because of the untimeliness. Then they come in with a brand new lawsuit making the same claims, and they characterize them as direct claims in order to avoid the outcome of their not having complied with the rules.
Mr. Lawson, if with the Chief will indulge me, I think is what Justice Mueller was getting at, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but the decision by the district court on attorney's fees is a discretionary matter. How did he abuse his discretion?
Well, I just don't think there's any facts to support the exercise of the discretion. I don't think that the give me that or the success on the declaratory relief claim, which was a direct result, and he said this, Judge Williamson said this, he was compelled to grant the HCNCE the relief it requested in the declaratory relief claim because of this court's decision in Eagle Creek 1. There was no successful prosecution of that claim by HCNCE. It was handed to them. All the other claims were contested, and we prevailed on each and every one of those. So I think if you do the overall analysis and you look at the underlying facts in support of the claim that there was direct personal injury and therefore these were not derivative claims, it was an unreasonable case to start with. It was pursued without foundation and overall frivolous.
Thank you, sir. I think you've answered the question. Unless there are any other questions from the court?
Thank you very much for the privilege of your time and attention. Appreciate it a great deal.
How much time does the appellant have remaining?
7 minutes, sir.
Idaho Code 68-119, applicability. The provisions of the Uniform Trustees Powers Act shall apply to all trusts, whether established pursuant to Idaho law or established pursuant to the law of another state or jurisdiction. We have a trust. Idaho law declares that Idaho Uniform Trustees Powers Act apply to trusts.
But there's another provision of the Uniform Trustee Powers Act that says it applies unless the trust document provides differently.
And within the fiduciary duties that are applicable under the common law and statutorily, as well as the constitutional provisions applicable, and that's the basis of our argument here.
Right, so to the extent you have the Idaho Uniform Trustee Powers Act and it sets forth the fiduciary duties, wouldn't that supplant the common law.
We have a clear breach of the duty of loyalty here. The trust subsumed the ownership of an equitable interest of beneficiaries. That's a clear breach of the basic duty of loyalty.
But that hasn't happened yet, has it?
Absolutely.
We've had a lot of discussion. More shares have been authorized, but none of them have been issued, have they?
When a trust is eliminated, all of a sudden my client goes from beneficiary to pure shareholder. It completely transforms the relationship here. This argument that the business judgment rule is the same fiduciary duties as trustees, it's nonsense. The business judgment rule is a gross negligence standard. You heard about this alleged independent special litigation committee. That was an attempt to sweep the actions of the board under the rug. The attorney they hired was not a disinterested independent attorney. It was the corporate attorney for one of the primary shareholders who was seeking to expand its property and didn't have the water to do it. Ms. Funky got her extra share. Mr. Davis dries up the creek to everyone below him. There's no monitoring. This was a whitewashing of a claim that absolutely was right and justiciable.
So can you respond to Mr. Lawson's statement during his argument that her number of shares hasn't been increased? Her new certificate gives her the same number of shares she had before.
414 shares, one miner's inch per share. So she now has, I mean, we have an automatic different proportion. When you've got double the number of shares, I don't see how that can't impact the proportionality of my client's shares.
Has the number of shares that she was issued increased?
I'm not sure. Again, she had a husband. They had different parcels of property. We've got Ms. Funky didn't come back for her second deposition. This was what we were provided with.
Didn't it just essentially take her husband's name off the share?
And issue it with a 414 share authorization, new share. I mean, the clear way to do this would have been to give everyone the new shares in direct proportion of their existing shareholding. And again, this concept that maybe this will happen at some point in the future, there hasn't been enough water year after year after year. New people are developing as we speak, and there's clearly a threat to the existing shareholders, whether they realize it or not, of this dilution and this attempt to water lands that have not been irrigated for decades.
So this all goes back to the Chief's question about ripeness then. How do you respond to that? Certainly I can understand that your clients don't trust, they didn't trust the former trustees, they didn't trust the board of directors, and they still don't trust them. But yet there's been no palpable injuries shown as of yet. So how is this ripe?
Mr. Lawson just admitted it in his oral argument. He admitted that it could dilute my client's shares. I'd submit that it has diluted based on an issuance of one of these new shares.
Well, they could revoke all your client's stock in the future. Just because they could do something doesn't mean they've done it yet and doesn't mean it's actionable, does it?
I think it means that we have a ripe controversy whether or not the board acted within its fiduciary powers to eliminate a trust and issue a number of shares. We're seeing actual application of that in a concrete action at this point.
So he filed a deck action within this case seeking a declaratory judgment that the board of directors can't deprive your clients of water. If you're trying to solve a future problem or trying to define your client's rights, did you ask the district court to do that?
We have not at this point, Your Honor. Again, this was a mid-litigation amendment of bylaws, and I think that raises all kind of red flags for any lawyer representing a party to litigation. And so my client sought redress at the earliest possible instance here.
I might give you that it is a potential red flag, but it's not a green light to a justiciable case, is it?
I think amendments to corporate documents eliminating a trust are justiciable at that point. At that point, a trust has been eliminated. If I'm a beneficiary of a trust and my trust is eliminated, I'm going to run right to court and address that.
Would you agree that it's not possible that those amendments could be applied in a lawful way that didn't hurt your client?
I think they could be, but there's a lot of things not in the record that indicate that they are not being applied.
If they could be applied fairly, and there's been no evidence that they haven't been, that the district court found, then why are they not entitled to the benefit of the doubt until they do something wrong?
Because, again, the issuance of the punky shares and the past treatment of my client of not issuing the shares upon its purchase of the property, I think there's a clear status of my client as being a disfavored shareholder.
And yet you've never been able to show that they've gotten a drop less water than they're entitled to.
Because there's no monitoring whatsoever by ECIC shareholders. And I do want to address something that Mr. Lawson brought up.
Well, hold on a second. Can't your clients hire experts to measure the water they're getting and then bring a claim saying, well, we're getting less than we're entitled to?
My clients do monitor, is my understanding.
Okay, so do they not have evidence of this alleged harm?
Again, at this stage, my clients have not per se lost a drop of water. I will give you that. I fully admit that. Going back to something Mr. Lawson said, though, my client is incapable of suffering harm. His description of ECIC's system is wholly inaccurate. There is the creek comes out of the Forest Service property. The diversion to the high ditch is on Forest Service property. That's where the split is. My client's property is downstream of the diversion to the high ditch. And so there's absolutely the potential that my client's proportion share could be diminished, whether that's through diversion down the ditch or through an application of a
Thank you very much, Council. We appreciate your attention and argument here today. This matter is under advisement. We will make a decision in due course.
Hold on, please.